You okay. Lucky listeners are listening to the Punk News Podcast for the week of September 10, 2013. Let's get this party started. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast, and let me tell you, podcast listeners, we have got the heavy hitters out here tonight for a jam-packed episode. Of course, it's me, features editor John Gentile, and I'm here with my two top dogs, the Top Ramens. I'm here with Adam White, managing editor, Adam Blanco. What's happening? What's happening?
Not much. Apparently, I missed like a really exciting show last week.
Well, every show is exciting when it comes to the Punk News Podcast, but yes, last week was pretty exciting. We had a game show where basically it was like a trivia game show about punk rock, and I gotta say, in some ways I was impressed with some of the knowledge that the kids knew, but in other ways I was a little let down. But, you know, conversely, you know, if somebody asked me, like some people didn't know like basic stuff about the Sex Pistols or the Ramones and stuff, but if somebody asked me about like Newfound Glory, I can't name Chad Gilbert. He's the only guy I can name in Newfound Glory. That's the only thing I know about Newfound Glory. Brian Yancey, who's here with us tonight, reviews editor. What do you think of the kids' knowledge when it comes to punk rock? Are we just old men and we know about the Sex Pistols but not Newfound Glory and Touche Amore? Or do the kids know all about those hip new bands and we're still talking about whether or not the Sex Pistols were or were not punk rock?
Well, John, I think punk rock knowledge, when it comes to people who are, you know, casual is not the right word, but, you know, just regular, perfectly normal fans of punk rock, they're going to know more about the bands that they like, than they're going to know about bands that they don't really like or unfamiliar with. I mean, that's just the way it goes. Now, it's different for us because, you know, I'm not going to say that, we're punk historians or anything like that, although John, you might be, but obviously our knowledge is going to be, you know, a little maybe not as centrally deep, but it's overall going to be wider than most people. And I'm not saying that to be a braggart or a pompous ass. It's just how it is, you know, based on what we do here every day at Punk News.
What you're saying really is that we have fat knowledge.
Yes, we have very, very fat knowledge about punk rock and related subgenres. Yes.
Is that F-A-T or P-H-A-T?
Oh, it's whatever you want it to be, right?
Yeah, I would go for P-H-A-T. So I just want to give a quick shout out to all the kids that played last week. We're going to have another episode probably in about a month that's already been recorded, and then about a month after that. I know a lot of people want to be on the game show, so stay tuned. We'll probably tape another episode in about 2 months or so. Maybe we might even tape two episodes then. In the meantime, if you want to talk about anything that we do on the Punk News Podcast, you can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. And on this episode of the Punk News Podcast, we have got a jam-packed episode. We're going to be talking about Modern Life is War, going on police chases. We're going to be talking about Bad Religion releasing a Christmas album. Is that ironic? We'll discuss. We're going to be talking about the new album from Balance Composure, which the kids are going crazy over. We're going to be talking about Fat Records' tribute to Tony Sly. The track list has been released. We're going to be talking about this new band, Diarrhea Planet. A lot of people on a lot of different sides of the fence on the name of this band and the band itself. We're going to be talking about Malaysia banning Lamb of God despite their overtly religious name. We're going to be talking about Slayer. Are they still Slayer? And, of course, we're going to be talking about our main man, one of our most influential musicians, one of our most, I guess, able to be approached musicians, Jesse Michaels, who just did a We'll Do It Live on the Punk News Podcast where a lot of kids got to speak to him. And I think we learned several factoids about Jesse Michael in his thing. And on top of that, afterwards, we're going to play a jam. And then we're going to call up none other than Dave Brocky of GWAR, because he just went on a trip to Russia for about 3 weeks and visited a bunch of World War II monuments. So we're going to give him a phone call and see what he has to say about his visit over to Russia and Stalingrad and all those wonderful, important historic sites. So without further ado, let's kick ourselves off with a jam. I just heard the new album by King Kong and the Shrines, which came out, I guess, about a week ago. It's a really, really good album. I think it's his best to date by far, because not only does it have like the up-tempo soul rockers like he always has, but it's got about three songs that are like just really serious, cold, and almost like Nina Simone type music. Quite thrilling. So tell me, Adam and the Yants, do you guys want to hear an up-tempo soul blast-out King Khan rocker from his new album Idle No More on Merge Records? Or do you want to hear the soulful, thoughtful, pure, raw emotion of King Khan?
I would say the former.
Well, good enough. Let's go for Born to Die, which has a negative title, but it's an upbeat song. This is Born to Die by King Khan and the Shrines on Merge Records off Idle No More. Podcast for the round table proper. So let's get this kicked off. And I gotta say, fellas, nobody saw this one coming. Modern life is War, which is a band that just reunited about 2 months ago, 3 months ago. Well, the drummer Tyler Olson is in trouble with the law. Here's apparently what he did. Nobody's quite sure what he did, but these are the reports. So of course, until there's an actual, I guess, lawsuit or case against him, nobody really know what'll happen. But here's what the reports are saying. Olinson, his reports say, the incident began Saturday night when Olinson, who was driving alongside a marked patrol car on Center Street, flipped off the officer, said Marshalltown Police Sergeant Melinda Rupp. The officer ignored the gesture, but Olinson stayed next to the patrol car and tried to run it off the road. Rupp said it was like he wanted our attention, so he got it. So, of course, he wound up in a lockup. The band said they're going to continue doing what they're going to do until they can't any longer, so they say it's not going to affect their tour. But I gotta say, it's not often that people in bands get in high-speed police chases where they try to run the cops off the road. We got another Nick Oliveri situation on our hands, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is like the high point or the low point in terms of these crazy ass stories of people in bands and their run-ins with the law, but it's the craziest one in recent memory for sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, how badass is the quote from the police officer there?
It's almost like it's out of a movie or something.
I know. I mean, like say what you will, punk rockers, about the boys in blue here, but I love this. Like, he wanted our attention, so he got it. Like, then, like, the shades come down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, if Tyler is in some kind of, if he's in trouble, if he's having some sort of abuse problem, we don't know about that. One of the charges that he is facing is operating a vehicle while intoxicated. It's his first offense, but you know, if he's having problems, we don't want to make light of that. Certainly, we obviously don't know if he is or not. But
I'll make light of driving up to a cop, flipping the cop off, and the cop ignoring.
Yes,
you try to run.
Yes,
off
we
the road.
Can make light of that part. I think we can make light of that because that is. It's pretty brazen, don't you think? I mean, do you think he knew that it was I guess it was a marked car, so I guess he had to have known, right?
Well, no, it was an unmarked car. So it's probably like one of those Lincolns that are just white, you know, and if you look at them,
right,
you can tell they're police cars, but you're not sure.
Right, okay.
So I have two questions on here. One of them is maybe kind of relevant, and the other one is just a waste of time because that's what we do. But the first being, is there, now I know that we don't know the other side of the story, and the band has kind of come out and said this on their Facebook page to people that were really criticizing the drummer there. So they, you know, they said, well, you guys don't know the whole story, you know, wait till everything comes out, you know, don't be judgmental yet. I'm completely paraphrasing there. But I'm trying to come up with a scenario in which trying to run another car off the road is justifiable.
I'll tell you, 1973, like, Steven Spielberg, thinking, like, the movie Duel, there's a guy driving a station wagon up the street and a tractor trailer tries to run him off the road, so he gets revenge by going up a big hill and then going into neutral downhill, so the tractor trailer flips over and like runs through a reptile house or something. Steven Spielberg's first directing debut, Duel. There you go.
Yes, okay, so
you can't outside. Beat me on the grade. You can't beat me on the grade.
No. It's okay. Outside of that scenario, what? I don't know, John. You're a man of the law here. Like, what would you do? Like, let's say my baby was in the trunk of that car. Would I be okay to run them off the road?
I mean, hypothetically, you can get a death penalty for that in some states. The way it works is if you intentionally like try to cause severe bodily harm for somebody. Which could include trying to run somebody off the road in a car, you could get the death penalty for that because that's attempted murder. I don't think most people would, but I mean, like, if you were convicted of either first or second degree attempted murder, you're going to jail for a while, you know? So, honestly, he's only getting a criminal mischief here to second degree, which is probably, like, you know, parole maybe, you know? So I think he's getting off pretty easy. My guess is he was just having a bad day, and he made, like, three bad decisions in a row, you know? But on the other hand, what is that – like, I can't really fathom a situation where I would try to run anybody off the road that wasn't trying to kill me. Like, if it's, like, a Mad Max scenario and, like, a bunch of, like, you know, like, leather barbarians are trying to, like, run me off the road, I'll try to run them off the road. But in a situation where somebody's just sitting in a parked car, I'm really not going to try to run that person off the road.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's...
Okay. Second scenario. How unmarked are unmarked cop cars in your neck of the woods? Because at least the ones that I see here on like in like the highways in Ontario, the unmarked cop cars that I tend to see, I've seen a few where actually they have like police written on the side of the car, but it's written on the side of the car in some sort of like transparent reflective tape that's more or less the same color as the car. So if you kind of get the light at the right angle, it says police. I've seen that. But then the other thing that we've seen is that where the car is just otherwise a normal car. I mean, like usually you can tell by looking at the tires, but almost all the ones in Ontario, and I don't know if this is like there's a law that says they have to do this or something like that, will have the words police interceptor in like in that little like plastic stuff that they use to put like the, you know, like the logo on the back of the car kind of thing.
Right.
Or like the name of the dealer or all that shit. Right. Like that in like tiny little font written in like one corner on the back of the trunk. I've seen that, and I see that on most of them in Ontario. So I don't know if like, they're supposed to, like, if there's some sort of law where, like, where they say, okay, you can't be completely anonymous, so you have to have some token things on there that says, yeah, you're a police car, or what the actual deal is there. But like, what about your neck of the woods?
Yeah, those same kinds of cars, unmarked police cars, exist in the States. It really depends on, like, where you are, I guess, because I've seen a bunch of different ones. I've seen those. Those are probably the most common. And then I've also seen just like regular looking cars with regular license plates. And like the only discernible difference is you can see their police lights when they're on, but when they're not on, you can't really see them. Maybe you can see them when you're up close, but if you're driving past them or, you know, speeding past them on a highway or trying to run them off the road, you would probably never know they're a police officer until they turned on their lights. So, I mean, I'm not really sure, but I've seen varying degrees of unmarked patrol cars. But most of them don't actually say police on them, as far as I know.
Yeah. I mean, you'd almost wish there'd be some degree of transformation that would happen when they unveil themselves as police cars. Like, you know, in the first Men in Black movie when they drive into that tunnel and like Will Smith presses the button and then like all these fucking engines come out of the back of the car and then they drive on the ceiling, that sort of thing, where like there's some sort of button where all of a sudden like it's business and the car becomes a police car. If one of you could get on making that happen, that would.
I would love to. I don't know if I have the technology.
Well, speaking of people without technology, here's an incredibly blunt segue. Bad Religion is releasing a Christmas album. I think a lot of people are shocked by that. Bad Religion has been anti-religion for quite some time. It's coming out on October 29. It's really more of an EP. It's got 9 tracks. Most of the songs are traditional, like Hark the Herald Angels Sing, O Come All Ye Faithful. There's a band called American Jesus, which might be a cover of Depeche Mode / Johnny Cash. And it looks like they covered Fear's F Christmas once, but that doesn't appear to be on this album. So, I mean, everybody's quite a bit puzzled. Do you guys think they're hating on Christmas? Are they doing a Bob Dylan and celebrating the music of Christmas in a secular way? Or are they doing a Bob Dylan circa 1977 and actually becoming quite interested in Christianity? What's going on here? A lot of people are confused and their interest is piqued.
I gotta correct your air first.
Oh, okay, go ahead. I was gonna do that, but go ahead, Adam.
No, I want to do it. American Jesus is a Bad Religion song. You're thinking of Personal Jesus, which is the Depeche Mode song that Johnny Cash covered.
Well, look who was just bitching that the kids didn't know about punk rock, and look who just got out punk on the Punk News podcast. Ouch.
Anyway, okay, Brian, go.
this is unexpected, I suppose. Even though I guess Bad Religion have been covering Christmas songs live for however long. I mean, despite their name, do we all agree that Bad Religion are actually like staunchly anti-religion? I'm not sure if that's the case, honestly. Mm-hmm.
True. You know, you mean like not to like a crass degree, like a degree?
No, I don't think they're like completely nihilistic. Mm. I think they're critical of religion when religion does stupid things. Obviously, you know, Bad Religion, they started this band when they were shit 15 years old. So they're at the time they were probably just thinking like, oh, what's a really cool like badass punk rock name we can think of? Bad Religion, you know, that kind of thing. But as far as like people getting upset that they're covering Christmas songs, like, okay. I mean, why do you care? I mean, this band is one of the most important bands in our scene. They have 17 albums worth of like really great punk rock. Well, most of it's pretty great. And I don't know. It doesn't bother me. It's probably not something I'll pick up personally, but you know, if they want to do this, then fine. Like it's okay.
I have all sorts of feelings about this, and I don't know which one of them is going to win out here. I don't want to hear Christmas songs anyways, with the exception of maybe On Christmas and then usually only the Pogues. So
sure. Well, yeah. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
So Bad Religion, who I'm a huge fan of or not, I probably don't want to hear these songs because I'll have heard them, you know, 9 billion times over the course of November and December in every discernible setting in my life. So, like, I'll have heard them enough, just like via osmosis, that I'm not going to want to purposefully listen to them, I think. Second of all, Bad Religion's a better band than a band that will do goofy covers of songs. So, like, if this was, I don't know, I'm trying to think who it would be. Like, if this was, like, Blink-182's Christmas album or something like that, you know, you'd be pretty sure that it would just be, like, a goofy, sped-up pop-punk version of all these songs and, like, you know, fart noises. But, so, I'm willing to bet that they would actually play a lot of this stuff fairly straight, you know, done within the style of the band that they are, but they're not going to, like, goof them too much.
Yeah.
Which, again, okay, sure, I still don't really want to hear these songs in the first place. So, yeah, I mean, and the other thing that I think is sort of interesting about this, although I'd like to hear someone from Bad Religion actually comment on it, is, I mean, like, I think you downplay it a little bit. Like, Bad Religion, yeah, of course, they've been super critical of organized religion. And I guess the argument that they might be trying to make via doing something like this is that there is a... There is a middle ground where they can approach material that has a religious connotation but not embrace the organization that exists around religion, which is more I think what they have the problem with. But I don't know. But I mean, you listen to things like, you know, the process of belief is an elixir when you're weak, right? So they clearly have voiced the opinion about that stuff. So maybe they're just doing these things because they're traditionals. I mean, like, if you listen to Cold as the Clay, which is Bad Religion frontman's Greg Graffin's solo record from a few years back, that was all kind of like folk and bluegrass, and there were songs on there that, you know, were originally spirituals or something like that, and he played them straight. Like, he didn't go and, you know, try to give them some sort of sarcastic social commentary spin or something like that just because they mentioned Jesus or whatever. So, like, I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't think they'd be cheap about it. But on the other hand, I don't know why I'd really want to listen to this. So I don't know. I think there's a really interesting interview to come of this, and I'm more interested to read that than I am necessarily to hear this. And I say that as a Bad Religion fan. So that's my incredibly all over the place contradictory opinion on this. I don't know.
At first, I was thinking this was kind of like an attack on these songs, particularly because they do a lot of non-secular tunes. They do like Hark the Herald Angels Sing. They do Little Drummer Boy. They do God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. They do some secular ones like White Christmas, but it's not like these are just like Christmas songs without an agenda, if you will. But then I thought, you know what? Maybe they're doing like the El Cheapo thing. Like, you know, like when bands are at the end of their career, they'll just do like a Christmas album because Christmas albums tend to sell. Like, you know, Tommy Two Tone or Sheena Easton's Christmas or something. But what I really think this is I think they're pulling a Ween, which is more interesting than both those things, is I think they'll never let on at, like, with Ween. Ween is a band that a lot of people like. A lot of their songs, you're not really sure what they're getting at. And I think what Bad Religion is doing here, unless I'm overanalyzing, which is possible, maybe they just like playing Christmas songs because they like the Christmas season. But what I think they're doing is doing a Ween where they'll never let on to whether or not they're serious or not with particular songs. And so it'll be an unanswered puzzle, which is really the point of the project. That's just my guess.
I guess that could be it. I'm not sure that. Yeah, I don't know. That's. I guess it could be that, but I'm not. I don't know if I agree that it would be. Although I don't have a reason why I disagree.
So you think? You just think they like playing Christmas tunes, and they're playing Christmas tunes?
Yeah, I mean, it's something they've been doing for a while, and it's, you know, maybe they figured it was time to release them properly. I mean, obviously, if they've been doing them for several years live, then, you know, there has to be some section of their fan base that enjoys hearing them or wants to hear them, I would assume. So maybe that's what this is about.
The other thing that probably plays into this is that, like, I'm pretty sure a good chunk of the members of Bad Religion are Jewish by birth, at least, or probably not by practicing religion. So it's not, it's, so I'm wondering if the interaction with these are more on a, you know, this is a cultural thing that, that we deal with, and we deal with it as, you know, people that live in, you know, North American society, and Christmas is a thing here, you know, that, that pretty much dominates everyone's life, whether you're Christian or not, for a week. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the thing about this is that, like, if this was to be done on a lark or something like that, you don't just make records with this number of songs on them, you know, flippantly. Like, it takes work to do all these things and put them together and record them and produce them and stuff like that. So it's not like they just, like, rattled this out in, like, an afternoon. I mean, they could have, but that's not, but Bad Religion is not the kind of band that rattles off songs in an afternoon, right? So.
Right.
I don't know. We're indecisive. That's, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Well, I think that conversation had some good balance to it, and I think we all maintained our composure, which brings us on to our next band, Balance and Composure. Balance and Composure is a pretty new band. They've got, they're releasing their second album. The reason I'm bringing this up is the new album just came out today, September 10, 2013, and I think contributing editor Bryce Lancer really liked the album, correct? And
as far as I know,
yeah. So
I personally have not spoken to him.
Yeah. Well, have you heard the album though?
I have.
Yeah. It seems like this album is like, I don't think 2 years ago the band was as big as they are now. I think they're way, way bigger. So I mean, is this going to be the song that makes Balance and Composure a legacy band? Is Balance and Composure here to stay permanently?
It's still too soon to tell. They're still super young. Like, these dudes are all, like, still in the early 20s. I mean, they've been around for, I guess, probably 6 years now. But when they all started this band, they were teenagers. So they have a ways to go. But I think, and if Bryce Lancer were here, I think he would agree that they've put themselves in a really good position to do just that, to become a legacy band. Now, one thing I worry about is, I guess worry is a strong word. One thing I'm curious to see how it plays out is bands that kind of imitate their sound, which has kind of already happened in the past couple of years. And there's been this weird proliferation of like pop punk kids, like, start, like, doing drugs and then starting grunge bands. Like, that's been a thing for the past couple of years. And that's, I feel like Balance and Composure have kind of, they haven't like single-handedly ushered that in, but they're definitely one of the biggest bands in that quote unquote genre. And
what would you call that genre, Brian?
There's a few different things. You could call it new grunge. You could call it basement grunge. It doesn't really have a popular name because I guess I kind of invented the term. But like I said, you're going to get a bunch of these imitators as like these bands are prone to get. And I wonder if that's going to dilute their legacy a little bit, or dilute the product, if you will. That's the only thing I'm curious to see how it plays out. I feel like it's already happening to a certain extent, but as of right now, they've been able to kind of rise above that and be like just different enough from release to release to where it hasn't affected them. But I wonder if it will affect them in the future when they get a few more albums into their career and they either have to keep thinking of new ideas or they end up recycling old ideas or whatever it might be. So that's what you always have to wonder about when you come across a young band that kind of blows up overnight, so to speak.
Yeah, they really did.
But we'll see how it goes.
Honestly, I had heard the name, but I couldn't tell you thing one about Balance and Composure 6 months ago, and now everybody's talking about them.
Yeah, they're from Doylestown, right here in our neck of the woods, John.
Very true. Very true.
But I mean,
I don't know why you'd be from Doylestown. Why not just move to the city or something? I mean, Doylestown. Jeez. They got like a 7-Eleven and like a Chili's.
Yeah,
someone's got to live in these places.
Yeah, I mean, it's a suburb. So people live there.
Yeah, but it's not even like a nice suburb. Like, I'm not talking. Well, we're gonna get some. You, every time I talk about any place ever, they're like, it's like, you came to Cleveland, John. Well, you can just stay out of Cleveland if you don't like Cleveland. I never like Cleveland. But Doylestown, I mean, Doylestown is not hell. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not the Congo. It's not the People's Republic of Congo. But I mean, it's
but it's close. Let's be honest.
Whenever I go to Doylestown, colors just seem less vibrant. I feel like I'm watching a TV show from the 80s, you know? Adam, is this your kind of music?
You know, it's not. And I listened to the record before the podcast, like immediately before the podcast. And on the one hand, no, it's not really my kind of music. On the other hand, I was enjoying it as I was listening to it. It was not offensive to me, which is, you know, which is usually a good sign. On the other hand, though, it's definitely not the sort of thing that, I mean, for me, come Your Endless Time or something like that, where I got to really look back at what's like blown my head off this year, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that's going to click and register, only because I feel like I've heard other bands that have this sound and they all sort of meet this similar, I don't know, level with me where like I enjoy them when I'm listening to them, but then afterwards I'm sort of indifferent. Like again, I just listened to this record and it was very nicely done and well put together and sounded good to me, and I couldn't really mention a lick of it to you. And again, which is probably more about like my mental state of mind than the band, I think that, you know, by all indicators that are not Adam, they're doing a really good thing here. So I'm, you know, I tilt my hat to them or something.
Not to drag us out, but speaking of bands that are blowing up, Balance of Composure, although they have gotten like really big in the past 6 months or a year, like if you graphed their popularity, it would be more or less a diagonal line that makes sense, you know? But more and more, I noticed this first with, what was the green-haired guy that did the cover? Toka, Matt Toka. It's like, all of a sudden, this guy's got like 30,000 likes on Facebook and hasn't even released an album. There's a couple of other bands that I see in the indie realm, maybe the quote hipster realm, but more like the major label hipster realm, that they've got like 200,000 likes, 400,000 likes on Facebook, and they've only released two singles. And so my question is, how does that happen? Do they really I mean, these bands have played less than 50 shows. Do they really have that many fans? Or I know on Twitter you can actually buy like followers. You can buy like 10,000 followers on Twitter. Is that what like these major labels do to make bands appear more popular? Or Yance, I mean, you do some PR stuff. Do you have any insight into, like, how do these bands all of a sudden have 400,000 likes on Facebook when Guar, who's been gigging for 25 years, only has 200,000? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it's funny you bring that up, because buying Facebook advertising is actually part of what I do at my real 9-to-5 job. I mean, if I had to guess, that's why these pages gain so many fans so quickly, is that these major labels basically throw money at Facebook and buy advertising, like targeted ads. Like, you go on Facebook and you see like ads in your little sidebar for like upcoming events or like suggested pages or whatever, or even like sponsored posts in your actual news feed. That's all targeted advertising, and it's based on demographics. It's based on your age, your gender, your location, your marital status, the pages that you like, your interests. It's based on everything that – basically all the info that you give to Facebook when you join Facebook. And, you know, it's – when done right, especially when it comes to music and, you know, a band that, let's say, has a single that's impacting radio that maybe some people are somewhat familiar with, I mean, it can be extremely effective. So if I had to guess, they're probably just buying Facebook ads. I don't know if they're buying Facebook likes necessarily. That's basically what they're doing by buying Facebook ads. They buy Facebook likes, but it's not – I don't know if it's the same thing as just buying followers on Twitter. I don't think it's quite the same thing.
Adam,
yeah.
You have insight in this, Adam. You have any –
Well, no. I mean, Brian's right. I mean, Facebook as a – oh, God, this is going to be super boring for everyone. Facebook has like – as a network has a little bit of a higher threshold for sign up than Twitter does. So it's a little bit less tenable a business model to go create, you know, 10,000 fake Facebook accounts for the sake of liking things en masse than it is, say, the people that manipulate Twitter numbers that way. So Brian's right. What they're probably doing is they're probably working Facebook's advertising system very well, which means a lot of the likes that they're getting are genuine in that a real human being has probably clicked them. But all that really tells you is that it's a fairly well representative group of the people that respond well to Facebook ads, which GWAR fans, for several reasons, one being that they're not advertising that way. The other is that GWAR fans are not necessarily, you know, hanging out on the GWAR Facebook page, are not. So,
right.
You know, it's one of those, like, you know, the people that the handlers of those bands have been very good at doing what they need to get attention on the social network that they're on, which really doesn't necessarily have any translation to the real world. But, you know, someone's got really good metrics to show their boss.
Mm. Well, speaking of things that unfortunately do translate to the real world, as I'm sure a lot of the listeners know, Tony Sly died, I guess, about a year ago now, maybe, was it?
Last August.
And Fat Records for a while has been promising a tribute to him with basically a whole bunch of bands covering his different bands and his solo work. And they just released the track list. I got to say, if you're into the whole Epifats, or more like just the Fat Records sound, it looks to be a pretty well put together release done to really pay tribute to Tony Sly's memory. I don't know if there's a whole lot to say about this, but if you're into this music, this looks like to be a genuine appreciation of Tony Sly's work.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think it's interesting. The most interesting thing to me about it is the cross section of bands that are on this. Now, obviously, a lot of it is, you know, like you said, kind of, you know, bands that were on Fat at the same time No Use for a Name was on Fat. You know, the whole Epifat sound that kind of came up. But then, you know, there are other bands like Get Dead. Fucking Frank Turner, you know, Brian Fallon of the Gaslight Anthem, obviously, like, they all kind of came up listening to No Use for a Name. And then you have, like, popular bands like Simple Plan and Yellow Card that are on this thing. And it's just it's a testament to, you know, how important Tony and Tony's music was to all different kinds of people within the wide range of, you know, what could be considered the punk scene. And I think, you know, I haven't heard the songs yet, but based on this, it seems like it's going to be a fitting tribute.
I mean, yeah, the band list on this is pretty interesting from that respect. And you have a lot of guys on here that I don't think, at least in terms of the North American market, don't seem to be as active these days, but definitely were on Fat when No Use was on Fat. So you've got guys like Frenzel Rum and Snuff on here doing stuff, which is pretty cool because they were on the label really at the same time that No Use was on and active. And then, you know, you've got contemporaries that, you know, different labels, but, you know, we're definitely growing up in the same scenes and stuff like that. So guys like Bouncing Souls and Pennywise are on here. You know, people that have been influenced that kind of fall on really like both ends of the spectrum. You got guys like Brian Fallon and Frank Turner on here. And then, yeah, you're right. On the other hand, you know, Simple Plan, Yellow Card, which makes sense if you think about it.
They
are not necessarily the kind of guys that would usually end up on a comp that Fat Wreck would put out. But I think that, I don't know, it makes this thing look a little bit more legitimate. Like this is, you know, actually people who were influenced or listened to or, you know, personally knew Tony and No Use for a Name, and, you know, they are therefore on this, and that's, I know, that's good. It seems very well put together. It seems like a classy thing.
Wow.
I suppose we should mention where the money's going too.
Oh yeah, where is it going? I don't even know.
The money is going to the Tony Sly Memorial Fund.
What does that go to though? Like that money?
It goes to Tony's family, like his wife and kids.
Okay.
I don't know how old his kids are, but I know they're like,
I think it's like a baby.
Like, yeah, like they're pretty young. So I mean, he left behind like a relatively young family. Obviously, he wasn't very old when he died. I believe he was what, 41, 42. Right. So,
real shame.
Yeah.
Well, there's not a whole lot else we can say about that, but I hope the compilation is successful and raises a few bucks for the family. and it looks, you know, people that are in that kind of music, it looks pretty good. And I gotta say, if you illegally download that album, you're pretty much a shithead. I'm just gonna say that. Moving on to things that are not shitheads, we're gonna play a tune real quick. The band Blast, there's three bands called Blast. There's Blast, there's Blast, and then there's The Blast. I'm talking about Blast. That's BL'AST. They were around in the later days or mid days of SST Records. They were kind of a combination of like Black Flag style punk rock and thrash metal. They put out three albums on SST. The second one is called It's In My Blood, which is, it's a really, really good album. Not a whole lot of people know about it because, I mean, 1987 SST was not in the greatest of shape, but the album is really good. The production is kind of whack, but the actual music is really good. Well, turns out Southern Lord resurrected some unreleased songs that Blast recorded back in the day in the late 80s, and they had Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters remaster them. The new album is called Blood, out on Southern Records. I've heard a couple of the tracks. It's really good. And this is off that, and it's called Tomorrow from Blast, out on Blood on Southern Records. Check it out. Got some more hip. Oh, actually, we're going to start this off with this band called Diarrhea Planet. I never thought I'd be talking about a band called Diarrhea Planet, but, you know, I mean, not a whole lot of band names are left. I think there's only about four band names left. The only reason I bring up Diarrhea Planet is because a lot of people are actually really, really liking this band. Their name, personally, to me, it's a really gross name, and every time I think of their name, I actually, like, basically think of what the name suggests, which is really gross. What's interesting is I was at a pretty, quote, hipsterish show about a week ago, I guess. And I heard people talking about this band, and they were like, yeah, like, Billy says he can't get over the name. Like, what a jackass. Diarrhea Planet is a great band. And I found it interesting because it seems the punk rock kids and the hipster kids are digging this band. Did you guys check out this? And what do you think of the name Diarrhea Planet? I really got to ask, what do you think of the name Diarrhea Planet?
the name, and I hate to say this because it sounds superficial, but like something about the look of the band totally screams hipster to me and sort of sets off that that function on my bullshit detector. But I like the song, so I have a feeling that I'd actually like the rest of what the band puts out. So the name is hard. The name is, I guess, a name that I just don't say to anyone in conversation if I want to try to look like a serious person.
Hey, Ma, check out this new CD. It's by Diarrhea Planet. Let's go visit Aunt Ethel.
Yeah.
We can listen to Diarrhea Planet on the way over.
And then my mom would say, "You're still buying CDs?" So, anyways.
My mom bought a cassette this weekend. So take that. And in a non-trendy way, my mom genuinely bought a cassette.
From where?
My mom goes to a lot of like garage sales and not thrift store. What do you call them? Flea markets.
Oh, okay. That's probably where you'd find them. Yeah.
She bought like 10 cassettes, mostly Willie Nelson.
All right, I'm into that. As for Diarrhea Planet,
Brian, can you think of a worse name than Diarrhea Planet?
Not off the top of my head, but I'm sure they exist.
How about Anal Cunt? Is that worse than Diarrhea Planet?
Define worse. I mean, it's worse in the sense that it's more offensive, but maybe it's better because it's more offensive. Mm. I'm not sure.
Just diarrhea itself grosses me out, like in any context. So I just can't take the name. I'm sorry, Diarrhea Planet. I listened to your song, but I just can't take the name. And I'm sorry, Brian. I'm stealing your sunshine here.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
It's not offensive enough, though, you know?
Yeah, like it's really goofy, I guess, which I guess fits in with the band's aesthetic and that they play like really goofy guitar driven like rock songs that are about I can't really even tell what they're about. All their songs seem to be like really self-reflective and about like the band itself, which I guess is a thing. The music itself is it's kind of fun. It's a little superficial and I could definitely see how people would find it, a little fugazi, a little fake, if you will, in the sense that here are some guys with long hair and sideburns and glasses and denim vests, and they're going to play guitar solos in front of you. And for some reason, you know, hipsters are going to like it, even though, you know, most of them have never seen a guitar in their life, unless it's been played by... I don't know, like a guy wearing like a weird hat and suspenders, and the guitar has been acoustic, and maybe the guy's wearing a tie as well. I don't know, but I always wonder how like it's really weird how bands like this get co-opted by that section of, you know, the subculture. Like it seems really random, but then. Like I don't even really know like how it works. If it's just by chance. I mean, obviously, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I listened to this album a couple of times, and I think it's all right. I think it's a little long and a little samey, which I guess I feel the same way about most of the bands that websites like Pitchfork fawn over. Is that they write like one really good song and then just repeat it 10 times, and then for some reason that gets like a I don't know, like an 8.6 or whatever.
Yeah, kind of the Baja Men. I think they gave the Baja Men album like a 9.1.
Is that true? Are you fucking with me right now?
Oh, no. They loved that. That was like their top song of the 90s was Who Let the Dogs Out. But they picked the remix version. Who Let the Dogs Back In.
Okay.
Okay. Now, okay. All right. Aside from that, but here's a question when it comes to something like this, is a band like this that I think on say like a sonic level, so like the kind of music they're playing, could very well appeal to like I don't know the punk rock crowd, whoever that is,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Are they by virtue of the fact that like they're one of these bands that Pitchfork trumpets. I don't even know if this is a band that pitched for trumpets. I'm just going off what John said there.
It is, and it was what Brian said. They got a really good review on Pitchfork.
Okay, so by that note, is our scene too quick to write it off? Are we right to write it off?
I wouldn't be writing them off if their name wasn't Diarrhea Planet. Like,
well, because
any other stupid Pitchfork like band names, like we're the Cassettes or we're the 8-Tracks or we're the Phonics, I'd be like, all right, let's give it a listen. But all I hear is diarrhea when I'm listening to this band. Like the actual sound of somebody like taking a crap. Like their name is just too visceral for me. I can't take it. Maybe I'm too tender. Maybe I need to go back to my own little world where all there is the Clash, Crass, and Black Flag and the Melvins. And that's it. There's four bands I need to listen to in my own little universe. It's like a Star Trek The Next Generation episode. And like Geordi and Data try to convince me to leave, but I don't know that I'm in my own little world. That's what I think it is.
All right. Well, what I was getting at though is that like you get bands that are like there's maybe not this one in particular, but like you often get bands that I think that like by like a completely ignoring the culture around them measure are good or are at least good at punk rock, whatever that means.
Sure,
that we will completely, not we, but like I guess like the collective groupthink of the scene will completely write off and be against for whatever weird little internet reason that we come up with. So I'm looking at a band like, say, like Be Your Own Pet, right? When they were around, which had like a couple records of, you know, basically loud, fun, screamy, snotty punk rock that was, you know, not championed by us, but was championed by Pitchfork, really, and had this member of this band is from, you know, this or that. I don't know. I forget what their story was. Someone was related to a record producer or something. There was some reason why it wasn't cool like this band. But we wrote them off because, like, oh, they're not, you know, an actual punk rock band. They're one of these Pitchfork bands. Like, they're never gonna go tour with Pennywise or something like that. I don't know what the measure is for it. Right, but this band, stupid name aside, you know, are they another one of these bands that, you know, very well could appeal to people, but we will instinctively write them off because, oh, they're a Pitchfork band, hipsters, blah blah blah.
I think that's definitely a prejudice that exists within the section of the section of punk in which we operate.
I don't want to say like we represent it or anything like that.
No. But it's definitely a thing that exists. I mean, there's
like the same thing happens to King Khan, right?
Yeah,
we got accused of that with the King Khan stuff the other day. We were fucking talking about King Khan for 10 years, right? But it was the same thing. It was like, oh, he's one of those Pitchfork fans. I'm like, what does that even mean?
King Khan's cool, man. People definitely should check out King Khan.
Yeah, I mean that's. There has to be a point in your life when you realize that, you know, if the songs are good and you enjoy listening to them, that you need to just be able to take down any preconceived notions that you might have for whatever reason you might have them and say, like, I like this. This sounds cool. Or, I don't like this. This sucks because it's not well done. Or, you know, it's not my favorite kind of music or whatever. But to not like a band or to, you know, sight unseen, completely dismiss a band because of what website is covering them or what website is not covering them. Like, it blows my mind that people think like that. And they do. It's the strangest thing. And obviously not everybody does that. Because there are plenty of bands that are kind of that kind of exist in both worlds and are liked and respected in both worlds, but you know, it's strange for sure. It's a strange like internet thing that I can't quite put my finger on.
True, I will say there are a good number of quote hipster bands that are really good. There's the Hound of Love. There's Enjoy, there's Puzzle, there's Garden, there's The Babies, there's Woods, there's, well, Jay Reotard kind of was. So there are a lot of those good bands, but I just can't get past the name. But speaking of a group of people judging something without really knowing about it, this just in, Randy Blythe, who just beat a murder rap out in Eastern Europe, has had his band Lamb of God banned by Malaysia. They had a concert scheduled at Malaysia, but it was, I guess, canceled by the Communications and Multimedia Ministry. Here's what they said. The organization of such events do not corrode morality, but also the faith of Muslims. Preferences by the heavy metal outfits that were also extreme also encourage its audience to lose the control. I read it like Hitler because I feel that it's censorship. I don't feel that it's censorship. It is censorship. Guitarist Mark Morton said, "It is very evident and a bit frustrating that groups, parties, and powers that have taken the most offense to our music and lyrics have themselves only made a passing glance at the content and meanings of those songs. We would invite anybody offended by our music to engage in a discussion relating the true motivations behind our work, especially before publicly slandering us based on assumptions and shallow misinterpretation." I don't know if there's a whole lot to say here except for, I mean, what are we going to say? Malaysia sucks because they censor bands?
Malaysia sucks because they censor bands.
Right, you Malaysia. I'm sure the people in Malaysia are nice, but I can't back censorship like this.
I'm rather shocked that that Mark felt the need to so level-headedly react to this.
That's what this band does, though. When, Life was, on trial for murder, it's like he's like, "I'm just going to do it." And then Mark Morton's like, "It's too bad."
Yeah, everything that he said is completely true about the reason why. You know, this was just probably some, you know, they probably were like, "Who's coming to Malaysia?" And they went through and they looked at, they picked a handful of things from the list that, you know, with a cursory, you know, Google search seemed to be, you know, I don't know, counter to whatever Malaysian values they're trying to enforce, and just, you know, cancel these ones, right? Like, I'm sure there wasn't, like, a whole lot of thought. Like, people probably did it, like, before lunch one day in the ministry there. But, the response from the guitarist looks like it took way more thought than the actual banning of them took. So I'd love it if just to happen, just the band would just reply with something like, you know, "Fuck Malaysia, Lamb of God declares war on Malaysia." I just left it at that. But I don't know. That's just me.
Well, speaking of satanic bands, although Lamb of God, I think, is not satanic. I think they're more of, like, a thinking man's heavy metal, where, like, they sound nasty and aggressive, but they're really just contemplative with abrasive music. But speaking of genuine satanic bands, Slayer have announced a fall tour. As people probably know, this comes after the departure of Dave Lombardo, who's no longer in the band, and also the death of Jeff Hanneman, which came as quite a shock. So I guess the only thing to really talk about is, without Lombardo and without Hanneman, and with only original members Tom Araya and Kerry King, is Slayer still Slayer? And if so or if not, are they worth seeing?
I mean, I think you and I agree on this, John, that I mean, I would say that Slayer died when Hanneman died. I mean, he was like the dark musical genius in that band. Would you agree with that?
I would. Kerry King has, like, assumed the band quite a bit in the modern years. But if you go back and read the credits, like, all the baddest-ass riffs in Slayer, well, not all, but, like, 80%, 90% were written by Hanneman. He really was a riff genius.
Right. So maybe he wasn't, like you said, he wasn't as active in that respect in the latter era. But I would also say that while all Slayer records in the modern era have at least been good, I don't think any of them have been great, and maybe that's because of his, you know, smaller role in the group, whatever it might have been. So, I mean, it's not really Slayer, but most Slayer fans probably aren't going to care that much, and they're going to go anyway. And they're playing huge venues at this on this tour. I mean, the place they're playing here, where are they playing?
The Camden Susquehanna Bank Center.
Right. What's the capacity there? Like 7,000, maybe.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah,
so
it is huge.
So I mean, there's going to be a bunch of people there, and you know, I don't want to paint Slayer fans with one brush, but there's going to be a bunch of people there, and they'll be excited to see Slayer in its current incarnation. I personally would not go, but I feel like most Slayer fans are just going to go there and fucking drink Jägermeister and yell Slayer.
Yeah, I'm a huge Slayer fan.
Between songs and, you know, do that kind of thing. That's what they do. You know, it's fine. That's what they're into. It's totally okay.
I'm a huge Slayer fan, but Slayer fans are really into buying $9 shots of Jaeger. That's like their thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Kerry King does all those Jägermeister commercials now, so he's totally bought into it.
Adam, are you going to go see Slayer? Are you taking the baby to see Slayer?
Please say yes.
Mm. Yeah, I guess we could. No, but I mean, I agree with you guys. There's not really. This is a band that has been that at this point has shed enough people that is so long from, you know, what originally brought them to prominence. Not necessarily in terms of the sound that they put out, but just in terms of time.
Yeah.
That you know, we're in nostalgia act territory. We're playing the hits, you know. We're the Rolling Stones at this point.
Rolling Stones are not a nostalgia act, Adam. The Rolling Stones are the best band ever. I hate you. Off the podcast. Get out of here.
No, I mean, he's right. I mean, I've seen Slayer live twice, and the first time I saw them, it was after Christ Illusion came out, which I believe was in, 2006?
Oh,
2008?
No, Christ Illusion is 2006. I was thinking of God Hates Us All.
Yeah, 2006. So I saw them on that tour, and they played for 2 hours, and they played exactly one new song from their record, which it wasn't like the record wasn't out yet. The record was out. You know, people could buy it. They played one new song from it, and the rest of it was just, you know, all the songs you would expect them to hear if you were a fan. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, obviously, but, you know, Adam kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's nostalgia act type stuff, and they were doing it 7 years ago, maybe before then. You know, I'm not really sure because I never saw them before then. Maybe they were doing it before then too. So at this point, it's been a while since they've been artistically challenging or relevant in that sense. Yeah. So people are going to go and they're going to have a good time, and that's
okay,
fine,
right? Like,
yeah,
that's totally okay.
Okay.
You can do that. Like, I mean, I don't know. Like, we went to see BB King a few years ago. Like, we weren't going to see BB King play like brand new material or anything like that, right?
Sure.
It was, hey, BB King's playing. Let's go see him play. So, but, you know, by the same token, that's what Slayer is. I guess it takes away somewhat from the newsiness of what they do these days, because a lot of people are just going to shrug and say, well, yeah, that's fine. That's what they do.
I wouldn't say B.B. King's a nostalgia act. I would just say he's a pro doing what he does best. I mean, he's kind of...
Well, yeah. Just that there's an established... I don't mean nostalgia pejoratively. I mean, like, there's an established brand that's there.
Yeah,
You're playing the type. You're playing the things people want to hear, and they're showing up to hear the things that they want to hear. They're not showing up to be challenged by something new or
that's
to
true.
Hear... Like, different from, say... Like Neil Young or someone that would do, you know, crazy shit these days, and people have to still kind of expect that he'll do that. Like, at some point you stop, I guess, pushing, and you say, okay, like, I've established as much territory as I'm going to establish, and I'm cool with that, and I'm going to play within that. And if they're comfortable with that, then that's what they do, I guess. That's okay.
Yeah, I've seen Slayer like 5 times, and I thoroughly enjoyed him every time I saw him, but I'm probably not going to see him anymore just because I don't want to see him without Jeff Hanneman. It's probably not going to be as good as they were back in the day. And the thing with, I'm a huge Slayer fan. Their live show was great, but the only thing about when you go see Slayer, Slayer has a huge amount of drunk assholes. Like, every concert has, like, one drunk asshole. Slayer's got, like, 30% drunk assholes, and they all yell, like, Angel of Death! Angel of Death! Like they're not going to play Angel of Death. They always,
right.
Newsflash, they always play Angel of Death. but speaking of people that like Slayer, Jesse Michaels did a pretty kicking thing organized by Kira Wisniewski. I think she had the idea to do this, right? Was that her idea?
Yeah.
Was it
your
idea?
Yeah, it was sort of my idea. But
well, that's Brian Yancey's idea. Brian Yancey said, let's get Jesse Michael on a We'll Do It Live, where on Punk News we just have famous punk rock celebrities come on and answer questions directly to fans, all thanks to Brian Yancey with his genius idea. It really was a good idea, because, I mean, why not ask Jesse Michaels? He's a legend. So there's no reason not to ask him. So Brian had the chutzpah to ask him, and it worked out. I think it's the best one we've done so far. Jesse Michaels came on and basically gave, seemed to me, pretty no bullshit answers to people's questions.
Yeah, I think this was really great, and obviously I'm thrilled that he was able to do it and wanted to do it and seemed very into the idea. It's really surreal, and this is not like a humble brag or anything like that, but it's really surreal when, you know, Jesse Michaels like emails you out of the blue and is like, hey, I have a new book, like, do you want a copy or whatever? And that's kind of how this happened. You know, he and I kind of exchanged emails, and I was like, hey, we do this live chat if you wanted to do one sometime. I'm sure our readers would fucking go insane over it. And luckily he was into it, and it turned out to be a really cool thing for them. So, and for us for that matter. So, but yeah, I mean, this was great. Like, these are always, you know, I'm very critical often of the punk news community, especially the commenters. I think most of them are jerks often. But you know, it's times like these when I'm glad they're there, because if they weren't there, we couldn't do something like this. And it's just a really cool thing, a really cool example of people just kind of coming together and just making something cool happen for everybody. And that's kind of what happened.
Yeah, this was really, really, it went over really, really well. And I mean, like, these always seem to be a lot of fun. And I guess, like, you'll get different levels of answers depending on how candid the guy talking wants to be with it, or how long they really choose to hang around and talk to our readers, because a lot of them will go past the time limit. But there's something about, I guess, the quality of Jesse's answers, and then something about just Jesse as a person, that everyone was just into this, him included, it seemed. So yeah, it was a really good one. It's really worth going and reading reading through the comments and picking up on his answers to things, because there's some gems in there, some good stuff. And I don't feel self-promotional at all telling people this, because we didn't do it, he did. So go read it.
Yeah, honestly, I think, well, two things to really take away from this is Jesse Michaels. I mean, he seemed like a pretty cool dude. It's always awesome when, like, I feel confident saying that Jesse Michaels is a lyrical genius. You read those Op Ivy and Classic Love lyrics are some of the best lyrics ever written, if you ask me, even Kamen Rider. And so when you meet people like this, sometimes they're like weird or annoying or whatever. And Jesse Michaels was just down. He was cool. But also he dropped off. You should definitely read this, Punk News listeners, because he put in a lot of cool facts, factoids. Like, apparently there's at least a couple unreleased Classics of Love's tracks, which is really exciting. He says he's not opposed to doing another collaboration with Tim Armstrong. And apparently they run into each other all the time because they both live in L.A. now. And other stuff like that. So I say go ahead and read it. So I guess without further ado, we're going to play a song, and then we're going to come back and we're going to telephone Dave Brocky of GWAR. So I think we ought to play a GWAR track. As the Punk News listeners might know, about a year and a half ago, GWAR's guitar player fled to the stars. Meanwhile, their roadie, Cordy Smoot, died suddenly, which is a real shame. Well, their new album is called Battle Maximus, and it has their new guitarist, Pustulus Maximus. And basically, the album is that, like, a guy called Mr. Perfect comes back from the future to battle GWAR, and GWAR fights him. And also, it sort of acts as an allegory of them getting over the death of Cordy Smoot. This is off the brand new album, due out the 17th of September, and it is called Madness at the Core of Time.
Down.
Punk-Loose Podcast, and we have a very special guest with us here tonight, Dave Brocky, I think 25, who's been a slave of Guar for about 25 years. Dave, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, Dave. Thanks for being on the podcast tonight. I really appreciate it. We're going to talk about your trip to Russia in a minute, but I'm just going to bring the Punk News fans up to date. Dave, you've been a slave for the Interstellar Galactic Barbarians, Guar, for about 25 years, correct?
Yes.
And so while they go around killing everything, you kind of help them get ready for that, correct?
Yes, we, get their war suits together, try to obey their confusing orders, tell them when to get on the tour bus, all that kind of crap.
Oh, but
anything that we basically do all the work.
Now, Dave, speaking of you doing all the work, recently you had an extended vacation, about 3 weeks, where you got to travel to Russia, correct?
Yes, I did.
Last question about Guar with regards to that, how did you get out of Guar's reins for 3 weeks so you could go off on your own?
Oh, they went off to go do some other weird shit. I'm not quite sure what they were doing. And I took the opportunity to get over to Russia. I've been a big fan of Russian history for a long time and all their hideous wars and battles. And took the opportunity to go visit Moscow and Stalingrad.
Now, you've been a fan of Russian history or just war history for quite some time, correct? Or not a fan, but interested in it, correct?
Yeah, certainly.
When did you first, I guess, get interested in the World War II conflict?
Oh, well, I was when I was a kid, actually, both my parents were actually World War II veterans. Both were in the Royal Air Force in the, fighting against the Nazis in World War II. And, we didn't immigrate over here into America. I wasn't born until the 60s, but I became aware of this horrible struggle that my parents had gone through in their youth. And, it just had a huge effect on me. It was like, this horrible thing called war. It pretty much destroyed my parents' lives. My dad barely spoke, and my mom could barely stop talking about it. I could tell it wasn't a good thing. And, so from a very early age, I was drawn to the complete train wreck and disaster that is modern warfare.
And actually, we'll get to Russia in the next question, but I want to ask you one last question about your parents. Wasn't your mom, trapped under a house for, 4 or 5 days or something insane like that?
Yeah, she was actually, a bomb hit her house. She was buried alive for a time with a good friend of hers. Just her friend's arm was sticking out through the wall, and over the course of a couple of days, the arm slowly went cold. And, my mom just had just all kinds of gruesome horror stories about World War II. And, as a result, they had a big impact on me and definitely made me, in many ways, want to dedicate my life to condemning and attacking war whenever I possibly could. I mean, a lot of people would see Guar, see what Guar's up to and be like, oh my God, but the truth is it is an anti-war statement. And, we're using violent methods in order to, illuminate the idiocy of violence. So I hope people get that.
Now, when you got to Russia, I don't know if you were surprised, but I think you stated the Russian people were very welcoming towards Americans.
Oh, yeah, sure they were. They're a little guarded at first. They're not quite sure who they're dealing with, but once they figure it out, they're like, oh, Americans, we love Americans. So yeah, pretty much all the stuff they told us about those people hating us all these years is pretty much bullshit.
And you actually got to visit Stalingrad in person, correct?
Yes, I did.
And could you tell me a little bit about that? What was going through your mind, what you saw?
Well, it was incredible. I mean, Stalingrad was the biggest battle in human history. It was the turning point of World War II, where the Russians pretty much checked the Nazis' advance into Russia. And then on, it was send them all the way back across the continent, all the way back to Berlin. And, the whole city, we were there for the 70th anniversary, the end of the battle. The whole city was decorated and full of monuments and statues and buildings and killer museums. And, we've been studying this very event, you know, pretty much our whole lives. So we knew a ton about it, but nothing really could have prepared us for actually going there. And yeah, to this date, you know, that's the furthest out that I've ever been anywhere. I mean, we went to New Zealand one time, but everybody spoke English there. You know, it was further away, but man, going to Stalingrad, that's about the craziest thing I've ever done in my life.
Now, you were there for May Day. Was it a joyous occasion? Was it a solemn occasion? What were the people like during the...
A little bit of both. There was lots of veterans and, you know, guys with medals all over their chests and little girls coming up to them, giving them bouquets of flowers. And so it was... It was a little bit of both, I'd say. Yeah, there was joy. There was some very solemn ceremonies as well. But mostly the Russians loved to party, and they definitely did a lot of it that week, and we did a lot of it with them.
Now, I think you got to visit a whole bunch of Russian and even German tanks while you were there, correct?
Oh, yeah. We went to the Kubinka Tank Museum, which is a gigantic Russian armor facility near Moscow. It's an actual military base, which up until just a few years ago was closed off to all Westerners. So, you know, we totally got a chance to check this place out. And, you know, not only is every Russian tank ever in there, but any tank that they've ever captured in all the different wars they've been in, and any of the tanks of any of their allies are in there. So, of course, they had every single captured, fucked up Nazi tank ever. And we all know how much the Nazis loved their tanks. So they had all kinds of stuff, including the crazy 100-ton Mouse super tank. It was Hitler's, like, stupid idea that if you built the biggest tank in the world, it would be the best. And it didn't quite work out that way, but they have the only surviving specimen of this machine sitting there, and just having studied it my whole life and seeing pictures of it my whole life, and then to actually be in its presence was a pretty interesting experience.
I think you mentioned that the German tanks were more sleek or stylish than the boxy Russian tanks, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely the German tanks were a lot more design-oriented. They're a lot more complicated, a lot more handcrafted. Whereas the Russian tanks were very crude, but very effective. As a result, the Russian tanks were generally superior. I mean, the Germans might have been better tanks, but, you know, I would rather have 10, you know, average T-34 Russian tanks than one, you know, kick-ass German tank.
Do you think that you got any insight into fascism or Nazism while you were out there and you saw all these sleek designs and stuff?
Well, you know, the Nazis were always very, very fashion conscious, very design conscious. It's one of the ways that they drew so many people into their movement. I don't know. I guess, you know, seeing it firsthand always gives you an appreciation for it. And, how we can't allow ourselves to be seduced in this way, because it's going to lead to nothing but disaster.
And now you also got to visit the Rijksmuseum, which is famous for its art, correct?
Oh yeah. The Rijksmuseum is great. We just got, we checked that out as well. It just opened after like a 10-year redoing. All the paintings look brand new. You know, they totally had redone the inside of it, and it's one of the greatest museums in the world. We also checked out the Van Gogh Museum as well, and that was amazing.
I found that quite interesting, because I guess the stereotype about Russia is they're known for their censorship, but their art is quite expressive.
Oh, yeah. For those people, like, who've suffered so much and gone through so much in their history, but then to have... such great art, such lyric art, such hilaric art, such hilarious art, such a great sense of satire and comedy. You know, it's not something that they teach you to expect from the Russians, but it is something that's definitely true.
Dave, what's going on, Dave? Dave, is everything all right? Hello? Dave, what is that? Dave? Hello? Hello? Hello, who's there? Who's there? What's who's this?
It's back to me, Otis. What do you want?
Otis, is Dave okay? What did you do to him?
I threw him out the window. I got sick of him mouthing off and saying that he works for me. He's full of shit.
Otis, that's a horrible thing to do, but I guess you're angry because you've got a new album coming out, right?
Yes, Battle Maximus is out September 17th. The new debut of Pustulus Maximus our first album since the departure of Flatus.
Well, while I've got you here, Otis, I might as well ask you about the new album briefly. Pustulus Maximus, what does he bring to the band?
Well, he's an amazing guitar player, like all of the Maximuses. He plays guitar. I don't know, maybe a slightly raunchier, more vicious style. Every bit is adept and fast. Every bit is smooth, but certainly he's got kind of a very raw, very vicious kind of attitude towards the way he plays. And definitely you can hear it influence the songwriting. It's a very vicious album.
It sounds vicious. So Gwar has had time to heal since the departure of Flatus Maximus, and now you guys are angrier than ever, correct?
I would say so, yes.
Well, Otis, last question. If I come see Gwar, I'm scared because I'm scared I might get killed or worse by the band.
Oh, don't be worried about that. As long as you stay about 40 or 50 feet away from the stage, you should be okay. Anything less than that, though, I can't promise that your face won't get melted off.
Oh, Otis, very last question. Unless you don't want to give any away the surprises, who can we expect to get maimed on stage this year?
Oh, I'm not going to give away any secrets, but all I can say is that, well, you do have a new pope, so it's pretty much a no-brainer that he's going to die. We've been killing Obama for the last few years, so I don't know, maybe we'll give him a skip. But don't worry, all the fields of entertainment, religion, and government will be represented, and I think you'll be very happy with the celebrity victims.
Well, Otis, I know we're all equally excited and scared for the new album and the live show. Otis, thanks for coming on the Punk News Podcast. And if you see Brocky, tell him I hope he feels better soon.
Very well, human scum.
And thanks for listening to the Punk News Podcast. As always, we had a blast. Adam, did you have a good time in the Punk News Podcast tonight?
I did.
How about you, Brian? Did you have a good time?
I had a blast, as always.
Like Diarrhea Planet had a blast? You had a blast like Diarrhea Planet?
I had a diarrhea blast tonight.
Too bad about Dave Brocky getting thrown out the window, though. That was a real shame.
Yeah, that's that guy. I mean, you know, he'll be okay.
Hopefully. Anyways, as always, the comments made on the Punk News Podcast, particularly those relating to Diarrhea Planet, are made by the people, making them exclusively, and do not in any way represent the opinions of punknews.org. Who knows? Punknews.org might love Diarrhea Planet. They might not. We don't know, because we don't represent their punknews.org's collective view, just our own. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. And until then, we will see you next week.